You're listening to The Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper.
And I'm Pooh.
And I'm Callie.
Well, you guys want to do it?
Yeah.
Go for it.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
You see, folks, Pooh has been recruiting. And tonight we had a duet on the Pledge of Allegiance. Don't go away. Tonight, as usual, we'll be illuminating. Since the earliest times, man has venerated the element of fire above all others. Even the most untutored savage seems to recognize in the flame something closely resembling the volatile fire that he believes dwells within his soul. The mysterious, vibrant, radiant energy of fire was beyond his ability to analyze. Yet he felt its power. It could be debated that as man sat huddled in the cold and the darkness of the night, watching as lightning struck a tree and the tree burst into flames, that man in his primitive form believed that he saw the presence of God. Indeed, it may have been this fire in lightning form that began the tale of the angel of light, flung to the earth after rebelling against God, and man picking up a burning branch, keeping it alive, the living fire, when it began to grow smaller and the light grow dim, he would quickly rush and get another branch and light it afire and watch it until maybe he fell asleep and it went out. And the next time he found a tree burning from a lightning strike, maybe there were two or three in the party and maybe they took turns and kept it going. And maybe it was this fire that caused man to ignite the first spark of intelligence and for the first time have original thought. For the philosophers of fire were certainly the first leaders, the first priests. They hoarded the secret from the others. And that has been their pattern on to this day. The vibrant, mysterious, radiant energy of fire was beyond his ability to comprehend. Yet he felt its power. And knowing that the sun was the only thing in the heavens that brought warmth, it was then a very short distance to the connection that the fire came from the sun, and the sun was the symbol of the mighty force of God. And of course, many believe that the sun was indeed God. The fact that during thunderstorms, fire descended in mighty bolts from heaven, felling trees and otherwise dealing destruction, caused the primordial human being to recognize in its fury the anger of God. Later, when man personified the elements and created the multitudinous pantheons, which now exist and have existed throughout history, he placed in the hand of his supreme deity the torch, the thunderbolt, or the flaming sword, and upon his head a crown, its gilded points, symbolizing the flaming rays of the sun, and all crowns on all of the heads of kings and emperors and mighty sultans have been the symbols of the rays of the sun. The mighty Zeus, who dwelt upon Mount Olympus and was the patriarch of the gods, held in his hand a bolt of lightning. Mystics have traced sun worship back to early Lemuria and fire worship to the origin of the human race. In fact, the element of fire controls to a certain degree both the plant and the animal kingdoms, and is the only element which can subjugate the metals. And, indeed, without the sun there would be no life on this planet. Indeed, if we were just a little closer to the sun, there could be no life on this planet. And if we were just a little farther away from the sun, there could be no life on this planet, at least not life as we know it. Either consciously or instinctively, every living thing honors the orb of day. The sunflower always faces the solar disk. The Atlanteans were sun worshippers, they say in the legends of Atlantis. While the American Indians are remnants, at least, of the earlier Atlantean people, they say in the mysteries, still regard the sun as the proxy of the supreme light giver. And many, many early peoples believed that the sun was a reflector rather than the source of light, reflecting the power and the beauty and the energy of God himself. And it is evidenced by the fact that they often pictured the sun god as carrying on his arm a highly polished shield on which was chased the solar face. Now this shield, ladies and gentlemen, catching the light of the Infinite One, reflected it to all parts of the universe. During the year, the sun passes through the 12 houses of the heavens, where, like Hercules, it performs 12 labors. The annual death and resurrection of the sun has been a favorite theme among unnumbered religions. The names of nearly all the great gods and saviors have always been associated with either the element of fire, the solar light, or its correlate, the mystic and spiritual light invisible, what you may now call the ether. Jupiter, Apollo, Hermes, Mithras, Bacchus, Dionysius, Odin, Buddha, Krishna, Zoroaster, Zarathustra, Phohai, Eel, Vishnu, Shiva, Agni, Balder, Hiram Abiff, Moses, Samson, Jason, Vulcan, Uranus, Allah, Osiris, Ra, Bel, Baal, Nebo, Serapis, and King Solomon, Sol, Om, On, are some of the numerous deities and supermen whose symbolic attributes are derived from the manifestations of the solar power, and whose names, ladies and gentlemen, indicate their relationship to light and fire. For Solomon, Sol Om On, is the name of the sun in three different languages. Most of you were not aware of that. According to the Greek mysteries, the gods, gazing down from Mount Olympus, repented that they had made man, and I bet you they still do. And never having given to the primitive creature an immortal spirit, they decided that no harm would be done if the quarreling, dissenting human ingrates, the whimpering sheeple of the world, were destroyed forever, and the place where they had been left vacant for a nobler race. And I bet there are many who believe that today. Really, look around you. Why should anybody come to save us? Are you sick? Or maybe you just can't see and can't hear. Discovering the plans of the gods, Prometheus, in whose heart was a great love for struggling humanity, determined to bring to mankind the divine fire which would make the human race immortal, so that not even the gods could destroy it. So Prometheus flew to the home of the sun god, and lighting a tiny reed with the solar fire, he carried it to the children of the earth, warning them that the fire should always be used for the glorification of the gods and the unselfish service of each other. Prometheus, you see, was a tremendous lightning strike. And the myth, the story of Prometheus, is the metaphor that the ancients used to explain what happened, because they didn't know anything about lightning or electricity, or, for that matter, much about fire itself. They burned the homes of their enemies. You see, men were thoughtless and unkind. They took the divine fire brought them by Prometheus and used it to destroy one another. They burned the homes of their enemies. Most recently, in Sweden or Switzerland. Before that, in Waco, Texas. I could go on and on and on. And with the aid of heat, they tempered steel, making swords and armor, and used these instruments to kill each other. They grew more selfish and more arrogant, defying the gods, but they could not be destroyed, for they then possessed the sacred fire. So the story goes. for his disobedience, Prometheus, like Lucifer, remember, these are all metaphors for things that man could not understand. For his disobedience, Prometheus, like Lucifer, was chained and placed upon the brow of Mount Caucasus, or some pronounce it Caucasus, there to remain with a vulture gnawing at his liver until a human being should master the sacred fire and become perfect. This prophecy was fulfilled by Hercules, who climbed Mount Caucasus, broke the fetters of Prometheus, and liberated the friend of man who had been in torture for so many ages. And remember, Prometheus really represents Lucifer. Hercules represents the initiate who, as his name implies, partakes of the glory of light. Prometheus is the vehicle of solar energy. The divine fire which he brought to men is a mystic essence in their own natures, which they must redeem and regenerate if they would liberate their own crucified souls from the rock of their base physical natures. Remember what I told you? You see, according to occult philosophy, the sun in reality is a threefold orb. Two parts of its nature being invisible. The globe which we see is merely the lowest phase of the solar nature and is the body of the Demiurgus, or, as the Jews call him, Jehovah, and the Brahmins, Shiva, the sun being symbolized by an equilateral triangle. The three powers of the solar disk are said to be co-equal. The three phases of the sun are called will, wisdom, and action. Will is related to the principle of life, wisdom to the principle of light, and action or friction to the principle of heat. You see, by will, they believe the heavens were created and the eternal life continued in supreme existence. In other words, the creation of the universe came from an original, spontaneous thought. And by desire was swept into action, and by action, friction, and striving, the earth was formed, and the physical universe molded by the lords of the fire. The fire mist passed gradually from the molten condition into its present, more orderly state. Thus heaven and nature were formed, but between these two was a great void. For God did not comprehend nature, and nature did not comprehend the deity. The lack of intercourse between these two spheres of consciousness was similar to the condition of paralysis in which the consciousness realizes the condition of its body. But you see, owing to the lack of nerve connection, is incapable of governing or directing the activities of the body. Therefore, ladies and gentlemen, they believe that between life and action there came a mediator, which was called light, or intelligence, Prometheus, Lucifer, and matters not what you call it. Light partakes of both life and action. They believe it is the sphere of blending. An intelligence stood between heaven and earth, for through its medium man learned of the existence of his God. And God began his ministrations to the needs of men. And while both life and action were simple substances, light was a compound, for they believed the invisible part of light was of the nature of heaven, and the visible part of the nature of earth. So down through the ages, this light is said to have taken upon itself bodies. And although these bodies have borne witness to that light, the great spiritual truth of the mysteries behind the symbol of the embodied light is that in the soul, they believe, of every creature within whose mind intelligence is born, there dwells a spirit which assumes the nature of this intelligence. And they believe that every truly intelligent man and woman who is working to spread light in the world is Christened or lightened by the actual labor which he or she is seeking to perform. The fact that light, which represents intelligence, partakes of the natures of both God and the earth, is proved, they believe, by the names given to the personifications of this light. For at one time, they were called the sons of men, and at another time, the sons of God. The initiate in the mysteries was always instructed concerning the existence of three sons, the first of which, the vehicle for God the Father, enlightened and warmed his spirit. The second, the vehicle of God the Son, enfolded and broadened his mind. The third, the vehicle of God the Holy Spirit, nourished and strengthened his body. Light is not only a physical element to these people, it is also a mental and spiritual element. And in the temple, the disciple is told to revere the invisible sun even more than the visible one, for every visible thing is only an effect of the invisible or causal, the generative force represented by an obelisk. And as God is the cause of all causes, he dwells in the invisible world of causation and always in the Trinity, and is represented by the symbol in the Greek alphabet, Delta. Delta. As in Lieutenant Colonel James Bobo Gritz of Delta Force. Apuleius, when initiated into the mysteries, beheld the sun shining at midnight, for the chambers of the temple were brilliantly illuminated, although there were no lamps of any kind. The invisible sun is not limited by walls, nor even the surface of the earth itself, because its rays are of a higher vibratory rate than physical substance. You see, they say its light passes unimpeded through all the planes of physical substance. And to those capable of seeing the light of these spiritual orbs, there is no darkness, for they dwell in the presence of limitless light, and at midnight see the sun shining under their feet. And if you believe that, I got a bridge to sell you. You see, they not only lie to you, they lie to themselves. They not only deceive you, they deceive each other. They not only manipulate you, but they manipulate all those below them who have not risen to the degree of initiation, where they understand that they have been deceived on the lower rungs of the ladder and begin to see the light. And I can assure you, the light they see is not under their feet. By means of one of the lost arts of antiquity, the priests of the temple were able to manufacture lamps which would burn for centuries without replenishment. The lamps resembled what is commonly called the virgin lamps, or those carried by the Vestal Virgins. They were a little smaller than a human hand, and according to available records, their wicks were made of asbestos. It has been maintained that these lamps have burned for 1,000 years or more. One of them found in the tomb of Christian Rosenkreutz had burned for 120 years without the supply of fuel being diminished. Or at least, so goes the legend. It is supposed that these lamps, which incidentally burned in hermetically sealed vaults without the aid of oxygen, you see what I mean? It was supposed that they were so constructed that the heat of the flame extracted from the atmosphere a substance which took the place of the original fuel as rapidly as the mysterious oil was consumed. Hargrave Jennings collected many years ago numerous references concerning the times and places where these lamps have been found. And in the majority of cases, however, they went out shortly after the vaults were opened, or else were broken in some strange way so the secret was not discovered. Or maybe there just was no secret at all, and maybe those who opened the vault and said they found the lamp burning were lying. No one really knows, and no one is likely to, since there is no proof of any of this at all. Concerning these lamps, Mr. Jennings writes, quote, "The ancient Romans are said to have preserved lights in their sepulchres many ages by the oiliness of gold." And here steps in the art of the Rosicrucians, alchemy. And remember what I told you, these are all metaphors for something much deeper that mean quite a different story than what you may perceive. This oiliness of gold, resolved by hermetic methods into a liquid substance, and it is reported that at the dissolution of the monasteries in the time of Henry VIII, there was found a lamp which had then burned in a tomb about 300 years after Christ, nearly 1,200 years. And two of these subterranean lamps are to be seen in the Museum of Rarities at Leiden in Holland, Netherlands. And one of these lamps in the papacy of Paul III was found in the tomb of Tullia, so named, Cicero's daughter, which had been shut up 1,550 years. Now, Madame Blavatsky, in her tome entitled Isis Unveiled, gives a number of formulae for the making of ever-burning lamps and states in a footnote that she herself saw one made by a disciple of the Hermetic arts, which she claims had burned steadily without fuel for 6 years previous to the publication of her book. It's sad, however, that upon publication of her book, those who asked to see the lamp were told that the fire had gone out. So the ever-burning lamp was, of course, a most appropriate symbol, ladies and gentlemen, of the eternal fire in the universe. Remember, all of these stories are metaphors. And while chemistry has denied the possibility of manufacturing one, the fact that many have been made and seen over a period of thousands of years is a warning against dogmatizing. Against dogmatizing. Get the message? In Tibet, the Lama magicians have discovered a system of lighting rooms by means of a luminous ball of phosphorescent greenish-white color, which increases in luminosity when ordered to do so by the priests, and after the departure of those who are in the chamber, it gradually becomes fainter until only a spark remains, which burns continuously. But since Tibet has been occupied by communist China for so many years, there is no way to check this or determine whether or not it is true. And after seeing the Dalai Lama at the Earth Summit in Rio de Janeiro, I wouldn't believe anything that he said. This apparent miracle is no more difficult, according to the mysteries, to explain than another performed by the Tibetans. You see, there is in Tibet a sacred tree, another metaphor, which sheds its bark annually, and as the old bark peels off, an inscription written in Tibetan characters is found upon the new bark underneath. These secrets of so-called savage and primitive peoples incessantly refute the ridicule which Caucasians almost invariably view the culture of other races. The Druid priests in Britain, recognizing the sun as the proxy of the supreme deity, used a ray of solar light to start their altar fires. They did this by concentrating the ray upon a specially cut crystal, or aquamarine, set in the form of a brooch or buckle upon the front of the belt of the Arch-Druid, and this brooch was called the Liath Mysikith, and I believe that I pronounced that sort of right. It's spelled L-I-A-T-H, the second word, M-E-I-S, I-C-I-T-H. And this was supposed to possess the power of drawing the divine fire of the gods down from heaven and concentrating its energies for the service of men. And this is a prime example of how ancient man, in his misunderstanding of science and what he was really dealing with, concocted a metaphor to explain how this crystal was able to start a fire. The buckle was, as we all know, of course, a burning glass or a magnifying glass. And many of the nations of antiquity so revered the fire and light of the sun that they would not permit their altars to be lighted by any other means than the concentration of the sun's rays through a burning glass. And in certain of the ancient temples, ladies and gentlemen, specially arranged lenses were placed in the ceiling at various angles so that each year at the vernal equinox, the sun at high noon would send its rays through these glasses and light the altar fires which had been specially prepared for this occasion. The priests considered this process equivalent to the gods having actually lighted the fires for themselves, and the sun was said to be doing the Father's work at the Most High. In other legends, the Most High God, represented by the sun in its highest position in the sky, in honor of Hu, spelled H-U, the supreme deity of the Druids, the people of Britain and Gaul celebrated an annual lighting of fires on what they termed Midsummer's Day. One of the reasons why mistletoe was sacred to the Druids was because many of the priests believed that this peculiar parasitic plant fell to the earth in the form of lightning bolts. Sound familiar? And that wherever a tree was struck by lightning, the seed of the mistletoe was placed within its bark. And the great length of time the mistletoe remained alive after being cut from the tree had much to do with the veneration showered upon it by the Druids. That this plant was also a powerful medium for the collection of the mysterious cosmic fire circulated through the ethers was discovered by the early priests who believed this and who valued the mistletoe because of its close connection with the mysterious astral light, which is in reality the astral body of the earth. And concerning this, Eliphas Levi writes in his History of Magic, and I quote, "The Druids were priests and physicians, curing by magnetism and charging amulets with their fluidic influence. Their universal remedies were mistletoe and serpent's eggs, because these substances attract the astral light in a special manner." You are poor, I don't know what you call upon the fruit. The solemnity with which mistletoe was cut down, they believed, drew upon this plant the popular confidence and rendered it powerfully magnetic. Magnetic. The progress of magnetism, they believed, would someday reveal the absorbing properties of mistletoe. So they understood and believe that they still understand the secret of those spongy growths which draw the unused virtues of plants and become surcharged with tinctures and saviors. Mushrooms, truffles, gall on trees, and the different kinds of mistletoe are employed in the mysteries with understanding by a medical science which will be new because it is old. Certain plants, minerals, and animals have been held sacred among all nations of the earth because of their peculiar sensitiveness to the claimed astral fire. The cat, sacred to the city of Bubastis in Egypt, is an example of a peculiarly magnetized animal. You see, anyone stroking the fur of a domestic cat in a dark room can see the electrical emanations in the form of green phosphorescent light, and this must have surely titillated the ancient priests. And in the temples of Bast, sacred to the cat goddess, three colored cats were viewed with unusual veneration, as was any member of the feline family whose two eyes were of different colors. Lodestone and radium in the mineral kingdom and various parasitic growths in the plant kingdom are strangely susceptible to the cosmic fire which today we know as phosphorescence. The magicians of the Middle Ages surrounded themselves with certain animals such as bats, cats, snakes, and monkeys because they were able to borrow the power of the astral light from these creatures and appropriate it to their own uses. For this same reason, the Egyptians and certain of the Greeks kept cats in the temples, and serpents were always in evidence at the Oracle of Delphi. The auric body of a snake, they say, is one of the most remarkable sights that the clairvoyant will ever see, and the secrets concealed within its aura demonstrate why the serpent is the symbol of wisdom among so many nations. And of course, in the mysteries, as the snake sheds its skin, it is the symbol of death and rebirth or resurrection. That Christianity has preserved in part, at least, the primitive fire worship of antiquity is evident in many of its symbols and rituals. The incense burner, so often used in Christian churches, is a pagan symbol relating to the regeneration of the human soul and was in use long before Christianity even came along. The incense within the burner, made from the extracted essences of various plants, represents the life forces within the body of man. The flaming spark burning in the midst of the incense is emblematic of the spiritual germ concealed in the midst of the material organism of man. You see, the spiritual spark in the mysteries is an infinitesimal part of what they call the divine flame, or the great fire of the universe, from whose flaming heart the altar fires of all his creatures have been lighted. The spark of life gradually consumes the incense, so the spiritual nature of man, through the processes of regeneration, gradually consumes all the gross elements of the body, transmuting them into soul power, symbolized by the smoke, and as a person ages, he therefore grows wiser. That was their explanation for the wisdom of the old and the deterioration of the body. For as the person ages, the gross elements are burned by the life flame, which transmutes them into soul flower, therefore the body diminishes and the wisdom is increased. Simple, huh? So what's all this research into geriatrics? Although smoke is actually a dense and physical substance, yet light enough to rise in clouds, they believed the soul was actually a physical element. They believed that through purification and the fire of aspiration, it has taken upon itself the nature of intangible atmosphere. Though composed of the substance of earth, it becomes light enough to rise as a fragrant odor into the presence of deity. While some authorities have held that the form of the cross was derived from an ancient Egyptian instrument called the nilometer, used for measuring the inundations of the Nile, others hold the opinion that the symbol had its origin in the two crossed sticks used by primitive peoples to generate fire by friction. In the History of Freemasonry, written by Mackey, 33rd degree Freemason, and this particular edition printed in 1898, there is only one cross listed in the entire seven volumes. And it is the swastika. The use of the bell towers and campaniles in the construction of the cathedrals of medieval Christianity, also the more familiar conventionalized church steeple, may be traced back to the fire obelisks of Egypt, which were placed in front of the temples to the superior deities representing the generative force or the rays of the sun, the male principle. All pyramids are symbols of fire, while the heart used on Valentine's is merely an inverted candle flame and is not in the shape of the human heart and never has been. The maypole had its origin in similar antiquity, where it is both a phallic symbol and an emblem of the cosmic fire, the generative force, and the dancing of the maidens around the maypole was, ladies and gentlemen, supposed to bring increased fertility to the land. For the maypole, again, in case you've forgotten the last few sentences, represented nothing less than the phallus. The prevailing custom of having churches face the east is, of course, further evidence of the survival of sun worship. And in the Masonic Lodge, the master sits in the east of the lodge, practically the only branch of the human race that does not observe this rule is the Arabic. The Mohammedans face their mosques toward Mecca, but still have their appointed hours of prayer governed by the sun. The rose windows and ivy-colored walls are survivals of pagandom, for ivy was sacred to Bacchus because of the shape of its leaf, and this plant was always allowed to trail over the walls of the temple sacred to the Greek solar deity. And all over Europe, you'll see the cathedrals covered with ivy. The golden ornaments upon the altars of Christian churches should remind the philosophical observer that gold is the sacred metal of the sun. Because according to alchemists, the sun ray itself crystallized in the earth, thus forming this precious metal, which incidentally, folks, is still being made. And if you visit a Jewish synagogue, the most elaborate synagogues will usually contain a huge golden symbol of the sun. The candles, so often seen adorning the altars and most frequently appearing in an uneven number, are a reminder that the uneven numbers are sacred to the sun. When three candles are used, for instance, they symbolize the three aspects of the sun, sunrise, noon, and sunset, and are thus emblematic of the Trinity. When seven are used, they represent the planetary angels called by the Jews Elohim, whose numerical and Kabbalistic values are also seven. And when the even numbers 12 or 24 appear, they represent the signs of the zodiac and the spirits of the hour of the day called by the ancient Persians, the Izids. And when only one light is shown, it is the emblem of the Supreme Invisible Father, who is one, and the little red lamp ever burning over an altar is an offering to the Demiurgus Jehovah, the Lord Builder of Forms. So, what oil is to the flame, ladies and gentlemen? Blood is to the spirit of man. Therefore, oil is often used in anointing, for it is a fluid sacred to the solar power. Because oil contains the life of the sun, it is used in large quantities in far northern lands where it is necessary to generate an abundance of body heat. Hence the proclivity of the Eskimos for eating tallow candles and whale oil. You see, it has stored energy from the sun. Now they say that the actual word Christ is itself sufficient proof that fire and the worship of fire are the two most essential elements of the Christian faith. For the rays of light pouring from the sun were viewed by the ancients, and check this if you don't believe it, for it's true, were viewed by the ancients as the blood of the celestial lamb, which at the vernal equinox died for the sin of the world and redeemed all humanity through its blood or rays. And then the world sank into winter. The mystery schools of ancient Egypt taught that the blood was the vehicle of the consciousness. The spirit of man traveled through the bloodstream and therefore was not actually located in any one part of the compound organism. You see, they did not know. They believed it moved through the body with the rapidity of thought, so that consciousness of self, cognition of externals, and the sense of perception could be localized in any part of the body by the exercise of the willpower. The initiates viewed the blood as a mysterious liquid, somewhat gaseous in nature, which served as a medium for manifesting the fire of man's spiritual nature. This fire, coursing through the system, animated and vitalized all parts of the form, thus keeping the spiritual nature in touch with all of its physical extremities. And at one point in history, since life was formed in the womb, and they believed that it was formed from a clot of blood, and the baby was endowed with intelligence, at one point in history, it was fashionable for those who could afford it to drink the menstrual blood of virgins, believing that this would make them wise. The mystics looked upon the liver as the source of the heat and power in the blood. Hence, the liver is significant, that the spear of the centurion should pierce the liver of Christ, and the vulture should be placed over the liver of Prometheus to torment him throughout the ages. I hope you're making connections, ladies and gentlemen. In this modern world, with the education available to every man and woman upon this planet, why are we still bowing down to ancient, ignorant metaphors created by priests in the dark, dim halls of history to control the common man and govern him with these stories and myths? Many of the things that I've revealed to you, you still celebrate. And you still perform ceremonies around these misconceptions. And, of course, through the ages, the priests slowly adopt the science that proves the metaphors and the myths to be wrong. And they change the dogma of the church. For instance, Galileo, Galilei, who turned the church upon its ear when he said, the earth revolves around the sun, and the sun revolves around some central core in the universe. Because the church had always said, not understanding anything about the universe, and observing the heavens appearing to revolve around the earth, that the earth was the center of the universe and everything revolved around it, not realizing that it was the earth itself that was turning. Yet the church held that the Pope was infallible and the Pope had decreed that the earth was the center of the universe and the universe rotated around the earth. And the church still maintains today that the Pope is infallible. How can this be? When is man going to grow up? Why do we need priests and governors? Why? Because at the present time and throughout the history of the earth, we have been stupid, ignorant, and for the most part, apathetic. And remember in the mysteries, a nation or world of people will not use their intelligence, are no better than animals who do not have intelligence, and thus are beasts of burden and stakes on the table by choice and consent. Makes you think, doesn't it? Occultism teaches that it is the presence of the liver which distinguishes the animal from the plant, and that certain small creatures having power of motion but no liver are actually plants in spiritual consciousness. They say that the liver is under the control of the planet Mars, which is the dynamo of this solar system, and which sends a red animating ray to all the evolving creatures within this solar scheme. The philosophers taught that the planet Mars, under the control of its regent, Semael, was the transmuted sin body of the solar logos, which originally had been the dweller on the threshold of the divine creature, whose energies are now distributed through the fire of the sun. Semael, incidentally, was the fiery father of Cain, through whom a part of humanity has received the flame of aspiration and is thus separate from the sons of Seth, whom they say was fathered by Jehovah. Isn't this strange? That you are told these things in church, you read these things in the Bible, they are taught these things in the mysteries, yet there is no way for anyone on this earth today to know any of these things. And if you'll read your Bible in Genesis, you will find that before Eve was ever created, God made man and woman. There were men and women on this earth, according to Genesis, according to those of you who say that the Bible is infallible, and if you believe that, you must believe, because it says it, that God created man in His image. Man and woman created He them, and He did this before. Before the people that you've been taught came first. Yet, you know, you have a tendency to read the Bible and make it fit whatever you want to believe rather than believe what it says. And what I'm telling you is in that dim chapter of history, nobody knows, nobody knew, and nobody's ever going to know. And there are battles raging on this earth today because there are people who believe that Cain was sired through a tryst with Eve by Satan, and that Abel, sired by Adam and Eve, killed by Cain, And then another son, Seth, who made war against the sons of Cain. They're still fighting this battle today. Today, folks. Metaphors and myths and stories made up by priests in ancient times to preserve the security of their tribes, to explain away that which could not be explained. And I'm not saying that it's bad to believe it. That's up to you. I'm just trying to impart a little intelligence here and there, and a little common sense, as my grandmother would say. If Jehovah is God, and if you believe, as I have been told by many Christians, that all things were planned from the beginning by God, then you have to believe that God created Satan and Lucifer. And if God created Satan and Lucifer, God is a tool. Or I should say, Satan and Lucifer are tools of God, created for a reason. So how could they be evil? I'm not saying they are or they're not. I'm just trying to generate a little logic here. I'm trying to make you think. Think about this tonight, ladies and gentlemen. If that is true, that all things were created by God, and that all things were set in motion from the beginning, what does that mean to all of us? And why do we believe all these silly things that make it all mean even sillier things? What has happened to us? Good night. And yes, I believe in God, and God bless you all.